Hi there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will spotlight a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in!
So how have you been?
We had an interesting weekend here. So Friday morning, I check the forecast and it says, we're going to have some thunderstorms. I think no big deal. This is going to be fine. About 1 o'clock in the afternoon on Friday, the sky turns black.
That's wild.
I say, oh, we're going to be in for a big thunderstorm. It'll still be fine. We'll lose power for 15 minutes and then it will be okay. It was not okay.
Oh no.
Thankfully, I wasn't going to be around for the rest of the weekend and the rest of the chaos. I headed up to Vermont to celebrate my grandpa's birthday.
Oh nice.
But for about an hour before I was supposed to leave, power goes out.
So scary.
I say, okay, this is fine. It's going to be resolved before the end of the day, and my dad is taking care of my dog. This is all going to work out. I get a text from my mother who is coming to pick me up. It's taken me 40 minutes to get halfway here.
Oh, no.
We're only about 10 minutes away. I am wondering what is going on out there. I see people only coming in from one side of the road. I assume there's something going on the other. So we got hit with a supercell?
What?
Tree limbs down everywhere. Power crews working through the night to get people's power on because it's 80-something degrees. It's getting hot in here. My dad had to take the dog to a cooler place because he was not going to be staying here. And I just saw on my walk yesterday, there was this beautiful big tree at the top of the hill. It was snapped in half.
Oh no.
I just know that whole tree was probably across the road, and that's why my power was out until 3 o'clock on Saturday morning.
That's wild. That is insane, because we spent last week at a festival, and it rained, but like only for a little. We got lucky in that sense, because this is like a festival I have been going to with my dad for the past 20 plus years. And so we had weeks where it just stormed all week long. And like right now this year, we took a hotel. Next year, I really want to go camp again. But like my husband couldn't believe this. I was like, when we came here, my dad and I, we didn't have a camping chair or nothing. My dad was just like, there's a tent. We will be fine. In the beginning, there was one year, I remember this so, like, this is engraved in my memory. We got there. It is always the final week of July going into August. And it just rained for a week straight. And, like, on Tuesday, there was no ground anymore. It was all muddy. It was like Woodstock. Our tent
slivered
away.
No!
Yeah, but, like, our tent slivered into the next tent.
It slid away?
Yes. It was so wild. And then this year, it was a lot better. But this festival, in a lot of ways, reminds me of what I imagined Woodstock to be like. Because it isn't only music, it's also arts fair. You can do, like, yoga every day. There is acrobatics and whatever. It is really, like, a very interesting festival. My dad goes there to teach magic to children. My dad's a magician.
Oh, no way!
So, yeah, that's, like, a fun thing. I say it every now and then on my YouTube channel and people are like, what? That's such an interesting job. I'm like, yeah, it is. So we got really lucky this year, but then final day, we drove up. We wanted to see like one final show. And I was like, the parking grounds, they seem a little muddy, but we'll be fine. No, we weren't. 2 meters in, we were stuck.
Oh no.
No way. I was like going back and forth, no way. So my husband got out, he tried to push the car.
Oh.
no chance, because it was fully loaded. We already had all the luggage, everything in. So I was like, fuck, do we have to need, like, take everything apart? We were really lucky because this nice family came around, and like even the kids, everyone was like pushing the car out. So it was fine in the end.
Again, true Woodstock experience. You're getting stuck there, man. So I had known of Today's Doll for quite some time, but I didn't know much about her, if that makes sense. I knew her as a footnote in several men's histories. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Leon Russell, Joe Cocker, Kris Kristofferson. Not to mention her connection to a rock and roll saga that has quite literally become part of my personal brand. As you'll see today, her life is fascinating. Today, we'll be learning about one of the most prolific session singers of the 1970s. It's the Delta Lady herself, Rita Coolidge. A lot of today's story comes from her 2016 memoir, Delta Lady. There's a really wonderful rotating cast of characters that cycle through the events of the book. I have to say, I was disappointed that she ends the story in the 80s. There are interesting and worthwhile points in her career throughout the 80s and 90s that I wish she talked about, and I've included some of those at the end of this episode. So, let's begin!
Rita Coolidge was born May 1st in 1945 in Lafayette, Tennessee, to Reverend Raymond Coolidge and his wife Charlotte. Raymond, nicknamed Dick by his loved ones, was of Cherokee descent, and Charlotte was Cherokee and Scottish. Rita was the youngest of four siblings. Raymond Jr. was the oldest, born in 1939. As she grew up, Rita was especially close with her sisters, Priscilla, born in April of 1941, and Linda Lou, born in October of the next year. Dick and Charlotte set a wonderful example for their children. Their marriage was happy, loving, and peaceful. They never once argued in front of their children, if at all, and instilled all their children with a love for art, music, and God. Dick was reverend at the local Baptist church. He loved painting and incorporated art into his Sunday school teachings. Meanwhile, Charlotte taught music. All the Coolidge kids grew up in Dick's church, with the sisters participating in the choir. Rita's family often said she, in quotes, could sing before she could speak. Remarkably, the sisters could harmonize by the time Rita was 2 or 3 years old.
Rita adored her father. He was generous and empathetic to all walks of life, with a strong moral compass. The Coolidges were a mixed-race family in the South in the 1940s and 50s. You could imagine how tough the going would be. In Dick's eyes, if there was injustice in the world, like racism, and you didn't say or do anything about it, then you were part of the problem. This principle would be hugely important to how Rita carried herself. When she was 13, Rita was in a serious car accident. She needed 60 stitches and was out of school for months to recover. When she finally returned, she caught her friends passing notes about her. One said, "Rita is a teenage Frankenstein." The crash and subsequent teasing at school shaped who she was, for better and for worse. She carried fear with her long after the crash, and her confidence was shaken. But the incident with her friends at school lit a fire under her ass. She was going to do everything in her power, not only to be stronger, but to achieve anything and everything she wanted out of life. Soon, she found like-minded and better music-loving friends, like rocking around the Christmas tree singer Brenda Lee. This blew my mind. I had to do a little extra research on this. But while Brenda was a super famous pop star in the late 50s and early 60s, she was still going to high school.
She was 13, I think, when she recorded Rocking Around the Christmas Tree.
Yeah, public high school too, it sounds like, which is even crazier to me. Usually famous kids or the kids of famous people go to swanky private schools or they're homeschooled.
Yeah, you would think so.
Yeah, Brenda and Rita were classmates at Maplewood High.
Wow.
And they're still friends to this day.
Oh, that's beautiful though.
It seems like when Rita invites somebody into her life, for the most part, those people stay with her.
In 1960, Rita and her family moved to Florida. Dick got a new job as a pastor at a parish in Jacksonville, and the whole family followed. There, Linda met and married her first husband, Larry Williams. Raymond Jr. joined the Peace Corps and traveled to Ethiopia. Priscilla was out of high school as well, leaving Rita the only one who had to change schools. She graduated from Andrew Jackson Senior High School as a part of the class of 1963. That fall, she began attending Florida State University, or FSU, and joined the Alpha Gamma Delta sorority. Greek life is huge at Southern universities, even today. It's a lot harder to break into the social scene if you're not in a fraternity or sorority at those schools. And in the 60s especially, the connections you'd made could be big boosts for your career. Never one to stay the course, Rita didn't stay in Alpha Gamma for long. She flew in artsy circles and fell into the bohemian lifestyle. Rita and her friends didn't live at the sorority house, instead renting their own apartment. Rita played her modest record collection of folk and the Delta blues and spent time with her boyfriend Joe Hutto. The couple and their friends often protested at places where black students weren't allowed to shop or eat. Remember, this was Florida in 1963, and Jim Crow laws were still in place. When Bob Dylan burst onto the scene in the mid-1960s, Rita was an instant superfan. She cited him as an influence her whole career. As you can probably tell, being a folky in a stuffy sorority just won't mix. When just one of Rita's friends got suspended for hijinks, the whole friend group got into. They all quit together. There was no love lost, though. When Rita played FSU in the 80s, the sorority put up a welcome banner for her.
I think that's so funny.
Yeah, me too.
Because they probably just saw that Rita was an alum and put up the welcome back Rita poster. Because, like,
no one could really remember.
Yeah, none of these girls would know that Rita quit.
No, of course not. That's funny. I bet they have, like, a register of everyone who was there. Yeah. And then when someone gets famous, they're like, great, they were associated with us. This is perfect for us.
Oh, yeah. As they keep, like, records of everyone who's been in the sorority, kind of, you know, family trees.
Oh, yeah,
like your grand big, your big, you, and then your little. My sister was in a sorority at her school.
Oh, wow.
So I got a little glimpse through her at Southern Greek life. But yeah, I just love that story about the banner.
Me too. It kind of reminds me a little of Grace Slick.
Yeah.
How she was, like, invited back and everyone was like, oh, who's that girl, actually?
And then she shows up with Abby Hoffman and they're, oh, she's that Grace Slick.
Yeah.
Don't let her in.
Still one of my favorite, like, stories on this podcast. I love that.
What did she think was going to happen?
Yeah, I have no idea.
Rita didn't pull off anything like that, though. She was pretty chill as far as things are concerned.
Yeah.
Following her bohemian spirit, after 1 year at FSU, Rita left campus to briefly live in New York. FSU had a program where students could volunteer at the World's Fair, and Rita jumped at the chance to move to Brooklyn. It was her first taste of life outside the American South, and she was so excited to break onto the scene like her idol, Bob Dylan. She actually did pretty well, playing the same famous Greenwich Village clubs as Joni Mitchell. But New York in the 60s was not a safe place for a 19-year-old girl to live and work alone. One night, Rita was mugged at knife point in the subway. She was so scared that she left the program early and moved back to Florida. After graduating from FSU as part of the class of 1967, she moved to Memphis. This worked out perfectly. Dick got a job at another parish in Memphis, while Priscilla was living there as a single mom and needed help watching her kids. Rita moved in with her and a roommate, Otis Redding's girlfriend, Venice Starks. While Rita briefly considered becoming a teacher, like her mother, Charlotte, she juggled helping out with her nieces, trying to break onto the music scene, and working for Pepper Tanner. Pepper Tanner did radio spots for about 3/4 of Southern radio stations at the time. Rita worked for them, singing the jingles.
Oh,
so
that's
every
great.
Time a radio station announces their, like, four-letter, I don't think it's a call sign, but they're four-letter, the thing they're assigned. My best friend Jack is all about radio, and he's gonna, like, yell at me for not knowing what that is. But every time that's read out on the radio, that would be Rita. That was her job, to read off all of these codes and you basically couldn't drive through the South without hearing her on the radio before she'd even recorded a single.
That's interesting. It is always interesting to me when someone starts out kind of behind the scenes and then makes an appearance later.
Yeah. She was also juggling her new boyfriend, Teenie Hodges. It wasn't a serious relationship, seeing as he had a wife and kids, but Teenie was Rita's entry into the Memphis music scene. He played guitar and wrote for Al Green and brought Rita backstage one night to meet Tina Turner. But this moment went from sweet to scary. I'm sure we'll get more into Ike and Tina's relationship when we eventually do an episode on her.
Yeah.
But this anecdote alone will show you how bad it was. We want to give you listeners the warning that there are multiple instances of domestic violence in today's episode. Ike and Tina had a bad show that night, and Tina expressed she was terrified of what he would do. She mentioned him splitting her head open. Rita was confused at first. She didn't have any visible injuries. Then Tina took off her wig to reveal a scar all the way from her forehead to the back of her neck. This part of the book broke my heart because the music industry still isn't great at handling abuse and abusers. See, everything that went down between P. Diddy and Cassie, that was just at the forefront of my mind. Tina was opening up to strangers for help, and nobody really knew what to do. Ike was just too powerful.
Yeah, scary, honestly. In Memphis, Rita was discovered by country rock duo Delaney and Bonnie. They were recording their first record, Home, at Stax Records. Rita was a backup singer. It was a wonderful experience for her. Delaney and Bonnie and friends were like one big family, and Rita fit right in. Singing gave her back the confidence she lost in her car accident. Also working Home were Booker T and the MGs, Carl Radle on bass, and Leon Russell on keys. What a killer lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Despite of him being a little strange, Rita and Leon hit it off immediately. He was boisterous and funny, but grounded if you got past his life of the party persona. Like a lot of men in the story, he was fascinated by her, a Cherokee Southern belle. Articulate, college-educated, and wondrously talented. When Pepper Tenors started their Pepper Records label in 1969, Rita was signed. They tried to get her to change her name to Antoinette Lovely. She passed, thank God, citing her Native American roots. In quotes, Cherokee societies were matrilineal. We had women's chiefs. When a woman married, she didn't go live with the guy's people. The guy came and lived with her. Women had a great deal of power in Cherokee Nation. I grew up with the belief of a cellular level that nobody was going to tell me what to do when I knew it was the wrong thing. Rita cut her first single with them, a cover of Turn Around and Love You. This song, about still being in love with your partner, even when the relationship turns abusive, is tragic when you consider events in today's history. By the time Rita and Leon made it to LA, it was a number one hit there. Her sister Priscilla found love too with Booker T. Jones. They got married, Booker was black, Priscilla was Cherokee and white. But when the KKK burned a cross on Dick and Charlotte's lawn, Booker and Priscilla moved to California too. Eventually, the whole Coolidge family moved there except Raymond Jr., who was a teacher in South Carolina. I feel like often when we talk about the 60s, especially on this podcast, we talk about how progressive it was and how there was so much change. And you really forget that, like, besides big cities, there was still a lot of that old kind of belief and way of life going on.
And even in big cities, the family lived in Memphis, Tennessee.
Yeah.
Rita thought her trip to California was just temporary. She brought little more than a suitcase and her guitar. But once she was there, everything fell into place, maybe a little too fast. She knew lots of people in LA through Delaney and Bonnie, and through Leon. Sit tight, because this is truly amazing. I checked Discogs, and Rita Coolidge's discography, including albums of her own, singles, and appearances on other people's stuff, clocks in at 77 credited releases. that's just the stuff she was credited for. She was doing uncredited work throughout the 60s.
She worked. I mean, she really did.
She put in the work.
Yeah.
From 8 o'clock in the morning to well past midnight, she'd be in the studio punching in for the likes of The Temptations, Jackie Wilson, and Ray Charles. She thought session work was, quote, the best job in the world. Sometimes she even got to arrange her own parts if the artists or producers hadn't done so already. Quote, I was doing every TV show in LA, so I didn't have to beat down a lot of doors to get my name out there. That's just something that the universe or the good Lord did. She also didn't have to worry about being seen as just Leon's old lady. Gorgeous as she was, people took a genuine interest in her. Things were only going to get busier for her. Delaney and Bonnie and friends were headed off to tour in Europe. Who were they opening for? Blind Faith, featuring none other than Eric Clapton. I truly cannot escape this man.
I would like to petition for Eric Clapton to be brought onto the Dolls Pod Bingo.
No.
Just for the sake of your personal connection there.
Just so we can, like, end this arc for good and I can just move on.
Because when I first read through this episode, I was like, man, this might be the first episode without any bingos. But now I'm thinking he should deserve a place up there.
At least on the bingo card. Yeah.
Give this man something.
Rita was both amazed and appalled by how he acted. He spent unfathomable amounts of money on food, alcohol, clothes, and drugs. She was also fascinated by all the groupies in the front row of these shows, clamoring for so much as a glance from the guitarist nicknamed God. This tour inspired one of the most important songs of Rita's career and the career of our previous doll. Rita wasn't credited for Superstar. Unfortunately, going uncredited will be a running theme of this episode. Mm-hmm. Delaney and Bonnie released their Superstar first. It became a hit for the Carpenters in 1971. Meanwhile, in August of 1969, Joe Cocker rocked day 3 of the legendary Woodstock Festival. Following Jefferson Airplane, Joe gave such a great performance that he went from an unknown to a sensation overnight. He released his 1969 self-titled album to capitalize on the success. I specify that's the 1969 self-titled because he has 2 self-titled records released within 3 albums. I don't know what led to that decision.
Maybe he wasn't that creative with his name. I don't know. I mean, on the other hand, this performance at Woodstock is so iconic because you just look at him and you cannot, it is so hypnotizing. You just cannot look away. There is so much energy within this man. So maybe this is why they thought it should just be his name so that people find it easy.
Yeah, and holy hell could he sing.
This performance at Woodstock is one of the most impressive live singing I've ever heard. It is incredible.
On that self-titled record, the first one, not the second one, is Joe's recording of Delta Lady, the song Leon Russell wrote for Rita. She's stated many times that she never stood naked in any garden, but the song was no less a product of their love. Delta Lady was a big hit for Joe and for Leon too. A Song for You is also about her. Rita much preferred that one. She says it's one of the most beautiful songs ever written. But their relationship didn't last. She moved out of Leon's house after he asked her to have a threesome with him and Carl Radel. She wasn't about that. Meanwhile, Delaney and Bonnie's relationship was crumbling. Delaney was both physically and emotionally abusive. He saw Rita as a threat and forbade Bonnie from spending time with her friend. Rita describes a conversation she had with Bonnie about Superstar when they finally reconnected years later. Quote, Bonnie even said, "Why didn't you say something, Rita?" And I said, "Because I knew if I did, then Delaney would beat the shit out of you, and it wasn't worth it."
After Joe Cocker's grease band dissolved in 1970, he was in a little bit of a pickle. To fill contractual obligations, he formed Mad Dogs and Englishmen. He included Leon, Carl, and drummer Jim Gordon in his band. Jim was a well-known session player, having spent time in the famous Wrecking Crew. He can allegedly be heard playing the drums and orange juice cups on the Beach Boys' Pet Sounds. Jim was 6'4" with curly blonde hair and blue eyes. He came off sweet, sweeter than Leon did. Rita fell hard for Jim, and their worldwide romance began. The Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour flew by the seat of its pants from start to finish. For one, Joe didn't know it was happening until 8 days before it was scheduled to begin. Delaney and Bonnie and friends, including Rita, Jim, and 20 other musicians, basically went on tour with Joe as a favor. It was a grueling tour. They played in 48 cities, having so many big personalities fueled lots of rivalries. It was a non-stop party full of drinking, sex, and drugs. Rita remembers the guys regularly lining up in the hotel hallway for VD shots. Rita largely abstained from the rock and roll lifestyle. She was having the time of her life playing with some of the most talented musicians in the scene and singing Superstar every night. All the while, Rita and Jim were in love, but their relationship wasn't perfect. Rita found out Jim was cheating on her with one of her friends. Drugs brought out Jim's dark side. It all took a turn one night while the crew hung out in Carl's hotel room. Jim quietly asked Rita to speak with her alone. She was elated. She was completely in love and thought this was him asking for her hand in marriage. Instead, he punched her so hard that she was knocked unconscious. She sported a black eye for the rest of the tour. Needless to say, their relationship was over. While it is clear from this story that the music industry as a whole wasn't good at handling domestic violence, Jim somehow kept his job after hitting Rita, the crew did everything they could to keep her safe. The tour manager always stayed with her, making sure she'd never be caught alone with Jim again. However chaotic the tour was, it got Rita her deal with A&M Records. You can hear her recording of Superstar on the Mad Dogs and Englishmen Life album. Yeah, it's a lot.
Again, this was another part of the book that just... ugh.
Yeah.
But I love that that tour manager kept Rita mm-hmm. safe. There are not enough people like that in the music industry.
No. Yeah, but I feel like there's such a big injustice for women in the music industry and, like, not only physical abuse, but, like, generally the way that women are treated in the music industry is so different. This really spoke to me when I read that Stevie Nicks and Christine McVie of Fleetwood Mac made a pact and they swore each other that they wouldn't be treated less than the men because mm-hmm. it was so common back then. So I feel like this really, it is insane that this wasn't even that long ago. And you can see that Rita, she wasn't just a backup singer or someone. She was kind of like a big deal. She had this wonderful solo record and this career going on. Yeah. So I feel like this is so disgusting, honestly, that this happened and that Jim was able to keep this job. Maybe she would have needed to press legal actions for something to happen, and maybe she didn't want that. But in the end, I feel like that tour manager or whoever was in charge would have had to take him just out of that tour. Oh, yeah.
We'll have to give her a name by the end of the show. Oh, for the record, dear listeners, we had some technical difficulties with Emma's mic, so we've switched over to Zoom audio, and we're joking about naming the lady that, like, says, Zoom is now recording.
Yeah. Audio recording.
So if any of you listeners have a name for her, please let us know.
It seems like we suddenly have an employee who's, like, chipping in.
She's our assistant.
Oh, yeah, she is. She's doing a great job today, working.
So, before Rita and Jim broke up, they wrote a song together called Time, Don't Let the World Get in Our Way. They never recorded it, but Priscilla and Booker T did. So there are two or three versions of how this story goes. According to the first, which is the one I was familiar with, During Layla sessions, Jim attempted to record material for a solo album on Eric Clapton's dime. Jim's noodling around with this thing on the piano, Eric catches him, and Jim bartered this piano part away in lieu of paying Eric back for studio time. According to Rita, quote, "Jim and I were on the way to England to record with Eric. I believe this would have been for his self-titled album. Quote, the day we were in the studio with Eric, I sat down at the piano and played it and sang. Eric seemed to like it, so I gave him a cassette and left it on the piano. Everybody in Delaney and Bonnie were there. Bobby Whitlock, Carl Radel, the whole band who was there witnessed it. Bobby corroborates the story, though you do have to take everything that man says with a grain of salt. This time, I believe him. I'll be including excerpts from both Time Don't Let the World and Layla here. The similarities are obvious and damning."
It's always just tricky when you do it with a really popular song.
Well, here's the thing. Eric never faced consequences, because when Rita eventually heard Layla, she instantly clocked the coda melody as being from her song. When she bought the record, she discovered she wasn't given a writing credit. She initially wanted to take legal action against Eric, first approaching producer David Anderley for help. He told her it was no use. To get to Eric, she'd have to go through Robert Stigwood and his management company first, and those coming from the Vinyl Monday verse will know how nasty Stigwood could be. I have beef with him, one-sided beef. Stigwood upheld his glowing reputation in today's story, telling Rita over the phone, and I quote, "What are you gonna do? You're a girl. You don't have the money to fight this."
Oh boy.
And, I mean, he was right. Lawyers were generally unwilling to represent lone women against very powerful men back then. When Layla's muse, Patty Boyd, eventually divorced Eric Clapton, she struggled to find a divorce lawyer willing to go up against him. As a result, she walked away with next to nothing. Rita could have won her case and could maybe get royalties, but if she lost, she'd quite literally be paying for it for the rest of her life in legal fees. So she walked away.
This honestly sucks because it feels so wrong. And it just feels so... Mm-hmm. I just wonder why Eric Clapton didn't give her that writing credit. Because I feel like that writing... No one would have said, "Oh, Eric Clapton, you're such a bad musician. You, like, wrote this with someone else." It wouldn't have had any consequences for him. He could have just done it.
That's the thing, Emma. The song credits Jim Gordon.
That's wild.
And not Rita.
That is really wild.
That made me mad.
Maybe he could pass it off as being like, "Oh, I don't recall who played it or this or what." But I feel like when you remember that someone else started to play the song, you remember who it was.
It's just, it's sneaky. I don't...
Yeah, it is. It feels like he robbed her, and he did. Mm-hmm. In 1971, Rita released her first two solo albums, self-titled and Nice Feeling. Though she'd built her reputation as a fantastic performer on the Mad Dogs and Englishmen tour, her albums weren't as successful as she hoped. Her live show at the Gaslit Agogo got a bad review in the New York Times. In quotes, "At first glance, Rita Coolidge seems to have everything going for her. She's a tall, slender, dark-haired young woman, lovely to look at times lovely to hear. But in her opening set Thursday night, Miss Coolidge's charm wore thin too quickly." Followed by, "Virtually everything Miss Coolidge performed was paced in a plodding mid-tempo and sung with an inflexibly bland interpretation. Even the presence of the Dixie Flyers, a briskly efficient rhythm section, couldn't seem to shake Miss Coolidge out of her lethargy. Nevertheless, her powerful voice earned her the title of First Call Session Singer. Meaning, if you were a big-time artist and needed backing vocals, Rita was the first one you call. She can be heard on After Midnight by Eric Clapton, in the chorus of Stephen Stills' Love the One You're With, and on Graham Nash's Better Days and Simple Man. Speaking of Stills and Nash, Rita met Graham while recording Love the One You're With. They flirted all day. He asked her out. She said yes. He asked her to call later. He lived with Stephen at the time, but when she called, Stephen picked up the phone instead. It seemed Graham had stood her up. Rita and Stephen tried dating for a while. He wrote Cherokee for her, but the two just didn't hit it off. A very awkward moment came on the way to a CSN gig. Stephen casually asked Rita when her birthday was, and she said May 1st. In response, he panicked and pulled the car over. Why did he freak out? Because that was his ex Judy Collins' birthday. And he still wasn't over her.
I don't think he ever got over her, honestly.
Oh, I know, me neither.
He still won't talk about Judy Blue Eyes, the song, which is, it makes me feel sad. But just wait for the rest of the story, because you won't feel bad for much longer.
When Rita got with Graham, they put two and two together and figured out Graham never actually canceled on that first date. Stephen set up the whole thing to steal Rita from him. That is wild. And they were friends. Oh, man.
That's girl-on-girl crime, even though the two girlies are grown men.
Yeah, you cannot. No, you cannot do that.
That's high school nonsense, too.
Yeah.
To orchestrate this big thing.
I mean, you would think they're all 15.
They sure acted like it.
When they pulled Stephen aside to calmly explain they were dating, they thought it'd be a non-issue. Graham dated Joni Mitchell after she dumped David Crosby in a song. It would be fine. Instead, a fight broke out.
What is it with all of the punching and fighting in this story? Also, I can't picture Stills fighting anyone. It'd be like seeing Peter Tork punch the waitress in head.
I mean, I don't want to be rude here or, like, anything, but Graham, Stills, and Nash, they don't seem like the guys to, like, throw
a
fist.
No, no.
I'm sorry. They seem like the kind of guys who would sit around the bonfire and just talk it out. They don't seem like physical men.
Oh, Graham had no idea how to fight, so he just got sucker punched by this blonde with sideburns. They didn't even really have to break it up, it sounds like. It sounds just like sticking
that's
one
so
in the other
funny.
Room.
No. And then that was fine. Till the day he died, David Crosby asserted Rita was the reason Crosby, Stills, and Nash broke up. But remember, this is David Crosby talking. He once accused Rita of putting quaaludes in the beans she cooked. There were two very big personalities in the group, add Neil Young into the mix, and there were three. There was trouble long before Rita showed up. I mean, the quaaludes are making an appearance again, and I'm just wondering, how do you make that assumption? How do you think, oh, we all had beans and now
this
we're
is,
all
this
high?
Is how.
I need to know.
This is how. Because Cross had gone on like a 3-day drug
binge. Great.
As you do when you're a musician in the 60s.
Man.
And he like went over and Rita had cooked dinner. And beans were part of the dinner. He eats a little bit and then he just crashes. He passes out. And when he wakes up, he's like, oh, it must have been Rita. She must have put drugs in the beans. No, there were drugs in your system, man.
I love how oddly specific it is. He's not like, she put it in the dinner. No. It was the,
it was
beans,
the beans
specifically. He knows that. They spoke to him.
Crosby, Stills, and Nash history is just so unserious. I love it. Rita was so in love with Graham, beans nonsense aside. She calls him perfect and, quote, as sweet as any human she ever met. Hearing from Rita about Graham and knowing about Graham and Joni Mitchell's relationship, he just sounds like an awesome boyfriend.
He does.
Like, he treated his girlfriends as equals. He bought thoughtful gifts. They wrote songs together.
He's one of the few men in the 60s and 70s music industry who seem like generally good guys.
Just a lesser toxic personality.
Yeah.
But as their schedules got busier and Graham's Songs for Beginners album took off, the two grew apart. They still have love for each other to this day. Rita is still close with his family, even. It just wasn't meant to be. Sometimes you're just not meant to be with that person, but you're meant to be in their life.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that was Rita and Graham. Fate had bigger things in store for her. On November 9th, 1971, she boarded the same flight to Memphis as singer and actor Kris Kristofferson. At the time, his career was just taking off. He'd turned down a position at the prestigious West Point Military Academy and a deal with Columbia Records to go his own way. Thankfully, it was working out. He wrote Me and Bobby McGee for Janis Joplin. That was a huge hit. To say it was love at first sight or, quote, love at first flight for Kris and Rita would be an understatement. Within the day, they'd decided on the name of their first child.
Wow.
Quote, I felt a connection with Kris the first time I looked into those blue eyes, and it wasn't just because he was one of the most beautiful men on the planet. It was a connection that went so much deeper. When he came, I knew it was him immediately. All the pieces fell into place. Kris thwarted a trip to Nashville to be with Rita. Memphis was just his connecting flight. They toured Canada at the same time, allowing for them to see each other's shows. As soon as tour was over, they moved in together. Soon after, Kris landed the second of the titular roles in Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid. Rita was also cast as Maria. The couple traveled to Mexico to film. They can be heard singing backing vocals on the movie's theme, Knockin' on Heaven's Door by Bob Dylan. Bob himself stars in the film as Elias. According to Rita, he stole some hats from set.
That seems like something.
Bob Dylan behavior, if I've ever heard of it.
I have to say, Pat Garrett and Billy the Kid is one of the movies that kind of like brought me into this entire like 60s scene.
Really?
At the same time that the music did, but this was one of the first 60s movies I saw. And I remember seeing Rita, and there, she isn't in the movie for long. Mm-mm. This isn't like a big part that she has. She stays very present and you keep her in mind. I think she is very, like, her acting is really pointed.
Which is interesting because she's not an actress. She's a singer.
Yeah. She makes an appearance and she has a really amazing presence. And I feel like that is something that probably came from the live shows and everything.
Yeah.
That you just look at her. There's a room full of people and you're like, yep, that woman. She's like the one I'm immediately drawn to. In 1973, Rita and Kris got married. The next March, they welcomed their daughter, Casey. Just 7 weeks postpartum, Rita went on tour with Kris in Australia. They brought infant Casey with them.
That blew my mind. Going anywhere 7 weeks postpartum. Emma, you've had a child. Did you want to go anywhere 7 weeks postpartum?
No, I mean, I could see myself going on like a chill vacation.
Mm-hmm.
But I cannot see myself going somewhere to work. I mean, I have no idea how you do that. I salute her for that. That is wonderful. When tour concluded, the family settled in California. Meanwhile, Priscilla and Booker T bought a nearby horse ranch to raise their family on. Booker had befriended previous doll Marijke Koger and her partner Simon Postuma and offered them a place to stay. He produced their Son of America album. Rita would sing backing vocals on their Mediterranean Blues album with Joni Mitchell. What a crossover. Other famous friends included Willie Nelson and his wife. With Kris, Rita had her first taste of success in the spotlight. She'd been a backup singer for so long, but Kris and Rita filled the void that a recently divorced Sonny and Cher had left. Watching the videos of their TV performances, the couple's chemistry was undeniable.
Have you seen any of them?
I have.
He just looks at her so sweetly.
Yeah. They seem genuinely in love. I feel like when you watch the performances, for some parts, it seems like there isn't even a camera there. They just seem like they're singing to each other. It is so beautiful. Kris and Rita released 3 albums together, Full Moon, Breakaway, and Natural Act, and won 2 Grammys. But their relationship was always volatile. As he got more and more famous, he drank heavily to cope with the stress, often sneaking alcohol after Rita and Casey went to sleep. Chris was drunk on set of his July 1976 Playboy shoot with co-star Sarah Miles. The spread was explicitly sexual in nature. Chris felt he had to drink to work up the courage to do it. Ashamed of what he'd done, he got blackout drunk at home. When Rita tried to help him to bed, he struck her. Upon waking up the next morning, Chris was horrified and ashamed at what he'd done. Oftentimes, when there's a promise to never hit or hurt their partner again, it's a sign of abusive behavior. A lie to get their partners to stay. Chris was the exception to the rule. He never put his hand on Rita again. But salt was rubbed in the wound when the Playboy shoot was published. Rita was humiliated, and the very next day she recorded, "I Don't Want to Talk About It." Thankfully, after clocking the similarities between himself and his character in A Star Is Born, Chris reigned in his drinking. He became a more present husband and father, and the couple were elated to welcoming a second child.
With baby number two and her newest album, Anytime, Anywhere, on the way, 1977 was slated to be a huge year for Rita. And it was. After nearly a decade in the industry, Anytime, Anywhere finally brought Rita her solo breakthrough. It peaked at number 6 on the Billboard albums charts. Her cover of Jackie Wilson's Your Love Has Lifted Me Higher and Higher is her greatest hit, peaking at number 2. Her covers of The Temptations, Marsha Hines, and Boz Scaggs also appear on the album. They were all hits for her. But in a heartbreaking turn of events, Rita suffered a traumatic late-term miscarriage. Completely crushed, she fell into a deep depression, and her relationship with Chris was never quite the same. He refused therapy. One day, while washing the dishes, Rita asked God for a sign. Just then, her cover of Higher and Higher came on the radio. It seems a higher power showed her that all she needed to overcome this terrible time was within her.
That's beautiful.
She cites the tour for Anytime, Anywhere as being just what she needed to make it through. Singing always healed her. When she came home, Chris let a rock star slash actor's ego show. Something about seeing his wife succeed changed his attitude towards her. In the best of times, he could ignore her. At worst, he would belittle and kind of bully her. Fed up with Chris's ego, in 1979, Rita threatened to leave. He swore he'd change for her, but it was too little too late, and in 1980, they amicably divorced. It seems the fans took it worse than their daughter did. Rita had to deal with a lot of sexism in the media in wake of the divorce.
Oh, man.
Priscilla and Booker T also divorced in 1979. To heal, they focused on their music, and by 1985, Rita had performed a Bond theme and became one of the first VH1 hosts.
That is so interesting.
Yeah. She had to put her career on pause to have nodes removed from her vocal cords. That's just kind of what happens when you've been singing every night for 15 years.
Yeah.
In 1983, Rita received chilling news. Her ex-boyfriend, Jim Gordon, killed his mother. He would spend the rest of his life in prison for it. Disturbed as she was, Rita wasn't surprised.
That would freak me so much. Mm-hmm. I would be horrified. I feel like if I was in this situation, I couldn't stop thinking about what if I wouldn't have left.
Mm-hmm.
What if I would have been the one?
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like a person who is able to kill another person, there is a high chance of them lashing out at someone mm-hmm. else. The feeling that she had was probably the same feeling Ronnie Spector had when Phil Spector killed that.
That could have been.
That
it's poor the feeling woman. That could have been me. What if that was yeah. me?
By the mid-90s, Rita added a Roger Waters solo album to her resume, singing co-lead on the title track of Amused to Death.
Another man I can't escape, Roger Waters.
Oh boy. Her niece and Priscilla's daughter, Laura Setterfield, was making her own way as a singer. Mother, daughter, and Aunt Rita joined forces to form Valela in 1996. I hope I said that right. I'm sorry if I didn't. Cherokee for Hummingbird, the group honors their Native American roots. They performed for the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta and are featured on Robbie Robertson's and the Red Road Ensemble's, wow, that's a long band name.
Yeah.
Music for the Native Americans. Valela would release two studio albums together, self-titled in 1997 and Unbearable Love in 2000. There's been some controversy in recent years over whether the Coolidge family truly is Cherokee, as they are not a member of any tribe. Abby did her research and didn't find much merit to this. Rita has done lots of research on her family history. It's not uncommon for indigenous people to have trouble tracing their family trees. America has a long history of erasing Native American heritage. In 2004, Rita remarried to UC Irvine professor Tetsuya Suda. But the marriage ended in divorce in 2012 amidst his professional misconduct scandal. He is now a convicted felon.
What in the world? What is with all of this in this story?
Wow. In 2014, tragedy struck Rita's family. Priscilla was victim of a murder-suicide by her husband, Michael. How is the story even real?
Marijke wrote about it on her blog because she was very good friends with Booker T and Priscilla.
Mm-hmm.
And just, again, like hearing about Jim, I cannot imagine hearing that shock. I don't know the details of what went down here, but one can only think domestic violence. It comes up again and again in the story.
And I think it is really interesting in this story because research shows that people who are in abusive relationships often grew up with that kind of dynamic around the house. And it is interesting that both these women ended up in these relationships when apparently their upbringing wasn't like that at all. Booker T, Graham Nash, Chris, and even her old friend Marijke all rallied around Rita. The next year, she participated in a Mad Dogs and Englishmen reunion show as a tribute to the late Joe Cocker. Middle sister Linda Lou Coolidge started music ministries at California nursing homes and at San Quentin Prison. She passed in 2021. Raymond Jr. became an English teacher and had three children of his own. He passed the next year.
As for Layla, Rita's at peace with not having credits. If she were to fight the case now, she wouldn't be taking royalties from Jim. She'd be taking them from his daughter, and she doesn't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Besides, the song has taken on a life of its own, beyond Rita, beyond Patty Boyd, beyond Derek and the Dominoes, and far beyond Eric Clapton. To this day, he still has not publicly acknowledged Rita. She never gave up on the vision of true love her parents instilled in her, but she's given up musicians, thank God.
Amen to that.
I didn't include this in the script because I wanted it to be a surprise for you.
I love surprises.
Okay, so do you remember the college boyfriend Joe?
Yeah.
So he showed up to a book signing when Delta Lady was released. Rita and Joe reconnected. They moved to Florida. They've been married for 6 years.
Oh, that's so beautiful. Oh, that's such a good ending to the story.
That is right person, wrong time.
Yes.
And then right person, right time. I'm so happy for her.
Yeah, I was just about to say, man, that first guy, he seemed like the best out of all of them. It feels great. And honestly, this gives me a lot of hope.
Rita Coolidge turned 79 this past May. She's living in Florida and still making appearances. Throughout her life, she's shown strength and devotion to her craft, to those she loves, but most importantly to herself. No matter how many times a man tried to knock her down or the cards she was dealt weren't in her favor, she handled it all with grace and incredible resilience. To this day, Rita still uplifts and inspires with her music. She closes every set with "Your love has lifted me higher and higher."
That's beautiful. I love that we're ending this episode on a lighter note.
Much needed. And thank you for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the life and career of the incredible and fabulous Rita Coolidge.
We would like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro tune. As always, we're Emma
and Abby,
your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. The buttons should be somewhere around here. I don't know. I can't see them. I'm recording this podcast for you. Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.